So we're talking with Ursula Rossum, who is now one of the organizers with Code Pink. And I've seen a lot of photos of Ursula recently hanging out at the Venezuelan embassy in D.C. What's going on down there, Ursula?
At the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., there is a group of activists that are living inside the embassy. They've been there for about a month now. And they call themselves the Embassy Protection Collective, and they are there to protect the embassy from being taken over by the opposition diplomats appointed by Juan Guaido. Juan Guaido claims to be the president of Venezuela, and he has been recognized by Trump as such. And he wasn't elected, but he was appointed there. And so the embassy still belongs to the government of Nicolas Maduro, who is still recognized by the United Nations as the president of Venezuela. So there are peace activists protecting the building. They have the keys from the Maduro government. There's members of the Green Party there, activists with Code Pink and Popular Resistance, and Vets for Peace protecting the embassy from being taken over by the pro-Guaido government.
Now, how has the local police been in terms of providing protection to the people inside the embassy? Because I have seen there seems to be quite a bit of people on the outside and even having problems getting food into the embassy to help feed the people inside.
On about April 30th or May 1st, diaspora Venezuelans living in the United States began gathering in front of the embassy. These are supporters of Juan Guaido, who opposed the Maduro government, and they set up an encampment and blockaded all the doors to prevent food and medicine from getting in. And the D.C. police and the Secret Service have had a very heavy presence there now for a couple of weeks, and they've been rather aggressive with the peace activists. Whenever the activists try to deliver food and medicine to those protecting the embassy from the inside, there are clashes, pushing by the pro-Guaido folks that don't want to let the activists deliver the food. And the police have only been detaining and arresting the peace activists. And on Wednesday evening of this past week, PEPCO, which is the Washington, D.C. power utility, under orders from the Guaido ambassador to the U.S., turned off the power to the embassy. So now the embassy protectors don't have any electricity, and there's no way to get food. And we've been able to get medicine in via the Secret Service and some friendly police officers. But they're cut off from food. They've had their electricity turned off now.
Now, I know last week we had another one of the orchestrated coup attempts by the United States, and the opposition held a press conference out in front of, one of the military bases, indicating the military base had swung in their favor, which turned out not to be the case. It just doesn't seem like the Venezuelan people are rallying to Trump's call to overthrow their duly elected president.
Before the attempted coup, most Venezuelans didn't know who Juan Guaido was. You and I received just as many votes for president of Venezuela as this person, Juan Guaido. And we have to realize that even despite any mistakes by the Maduro government, there are many people there that still support him because he's inherited the legacy of Chavez, who by nationalizing the country's oil reserves was able to invest heavily in healthcare and education and housing. It's from what I understand, it's a very politically polarized society right now. And those in front, that are blockading the food are loyal to Guaido, while the embassy protectors have been receiving many messages from people in Venezuela via Twitter videos and Twitter messages, thanking them for their actions. So it's a very polarized situation. And I'll just add that Trump has vocalized concern about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. But one thing that the mainstream media fails to cover is that in August of 2017, Trump imposed sanctions on Venezuela, which prevent the flow of food, medicine, and medical devices into the country. And according to a recent report by the Center for Economic Policy Research, this has resulted in the death of at least 40,000 people. When we talk about the sanctions, what we're talking about is medications to, like antiretroviral medications for people with HIV, for people that need dialysis, or people that need cancer treatments, aren't getting what they need because of U.S. sanctions against Venezuela. So it these sanctions aggravate an already difficult economic situation. And we see that this is a tactic that the U.S. uses repeatedly to try to destabilize governments that oppose U.S. economic hegemony. In the 90s, U.S. sanctions against Iraq were responsible for the death of over 500,000 children. So what we're seeing now in Venezuela is, you know, part of the pattern of U.S. foreign policy in the world.
Now, like many young people, unfortunately, it seems like you have to patch together a couple of different jobs in order to support yourself. And so I understand your other job has been working with the Physicians for National Health Program for a couple of years, trying to enact a single-payer health care system. Many of us hope that with the Senate going Democrat this year, we're finally there. Hasn't quite occurred yet. I know the hearing is coming up on May 28th. What's the prospects, and why do we want single-payer in New York? Isn't it going to raise our taxes?
So many people struggle to get health care, not just due to lack of insurance, but because their current insurance is unaffordable due to high copays, high deductibles. People are skipping things like medication, regular checkups. And on May 28th, we're going to have a really historic opportunity in New York to turn out in Albany and to speak about all the different reasons why we need a universal health program here in New York. This is going to be an opportunity for people to share about their personal experiences, struggling to get what they need within the system. And we are planning on publishing a report based on a survey we did around the state. 2,500 people around New York shared their stories with the Campaign for New York Health of barriers accessing care. We've heard so many stories of people losing their houses, going into severe medical debt that destroys their credit scores. There's so many heartbreaking situations of people not getting the care they need. And so on the 28th is really going to be an opportunity for New York lawmakers to hear from the people of New York why we so desperately need universal health care.
Do we have any prospect of passing it this session, or is there something coming down a few years down the line?
We are going to pass universal health care in New York and in this country. It's just a matter of when. And so you never know what's going to happen in Albany. And the hearing coming up is really our opportunity to keep making the case to the public and to lawmakers about why passing the New York Health Act is essential. So right now, at this moment, we have 30 co-sponsors in the state Senate for the bill. 32 is a majority. So at the moment, we're really working hard to get some of those Democrats who ran on their support of the New York Health Act to actually follow through on their commitment and sponsor the bill. So
can you give me the 30 seconds, which is all we got? Why is single payer good for New York?
Single-payer health care will guarantee health care coverage to everyone, regardless of your income, your age, your immigration status. It'll save us money and give us the peace of mind we all deserve.
So we've been talking with Ursula Rossum, who's Code Pink and Physicians for National Health Program. This has been Mark Dunley for Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. Quickly, your two biggest websites.
So for Code Pink, if you want to learn about what we're doing related to Venezuela, codepink.org/Venezuela. And to learn about the New York Health Campaign, visit nyhcampaign.org.